Romeo, India, Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel. His name, his call letters are Kilo 2, Kilo, Echo, Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this enthusiastic crew that meets most Sunday evenings to discuss their favorite subject, ham radio. We claim this is a new, improved technical net, which means that during the first hour, we try to handle essentially everybody who signs in with the more brief answers. And the subjects where we're going to dig a little bit deeper, that takes place beyond the first hour. At the end of the first hour, we go over to the mailbag, possibly to a space report, and then we dig into the more serious subjects. So, a person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KE2EJ. Eric, and yes. So give me your call letters and name at this time. K2RIW.
N2MB, question.
Bet you that's Barry. Okay, and Barry's our first sign-in. Who else do we have tonight? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
KC2OJO. Yes.
And Mr. OJO, please tell me your name, sir.
Howard.
Okay, so far we've got Barry and Howard. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name. K2RIW listening for the TechNet.
N2NYW. Ed over here in Sheepshead Bay.
Okay, NYW, Ed, we got you. Anyone else? Give me your call letters and name, please. K2RIW listening.
Good evening, K2KEY.
Mel recognized, and one last call. So far, we've got Barry, Howard, and Ed in that order. Give me your call letters if you want to sign in to the fast portion of the TechNet. K2RIW listening.
Check me in, Dick, N2EL. I'm mobile right now, but I got no questions, just checking in.
We got you, Rich. Okay. Barry, go ahead with your first question. N2, moon bounce, K2RIW.
Okay, yeah, it's a quickie. You and I were discussing something earlier, I was bringing up this little experiment that was done, I think, in 1929. And they were observing photons going through a double slit in a piece of metal or something, and they're projecting it on a wall in the back, and they were observing it. And you had come up with the statement, which is mind-boggling, really, that there is no way for them to measure the photons. They can't count them, because to count them would mean that they have to use them. They would have to be put on a photo plate or something. They would never make it to their target. That's the point. So why do they keep saying this? And famous scientists keep saying this, that experiment was done. How did they do it? Have you any suggestions? Where would I look to see how they did it? K2RW and 2MB and the net.
Yeah, this is a tough one. As I see it, Barry, I'm not an expert in this area. I'm not an expert in any area. But my understanding of photons is that it's the smallest amount of energy that's possible at a particular frequency. If I chose a frequency of 432 megacycles, one of your and my favorite frequencies, and kept turning the signal generator down to lower and lower numbers, the smallest amount of energy we could be issuing would be one photon at 432 megacycles. And I went through this calculation once. I think one photon at 432 megs has an amount of energy equal to something like minus 240 dBm. Extremely small amount of energy. And so once you get down to the smallest little particle of energy, and any real signal you and I have ever listened to contains zillions and zillions of photons flying by every second. But if I got down to the smallest possible unit of energy, one photon, and by the way, just to make it a little bit more clear to people, let me drop. E equals h nu is a famous equation. I think it's a Planck's constant, but anyhow, once you know the wavelength, you know how much energy is in a single photon. At optical frequencies, 550 nanometers, middle of yellow-green, there's a significant amount of energy in one single photon. You go to higher frequencies or a smaller wavelength than that, in other words, ultraviolet or X-ray, the amount of energy per photon is called ionizing. In other words, now the amount of energy in one single photon is capable of making a molecular change. It's capable, for instance, of hitting the DNA of one of your cells and potentially changing it. As you go down below optical frequencies into the infrared and the far infrared and the upper microwave and so on, the amount of energy per photon by that equation gets smaller and smaller. It's no longer ionizing radiation. RF energy is way into the area of non-ionizing radiation. Each individual photon no longer has enough energy to do any damage to a biological material. There's a catch. Let me drop. And that is, each individual photon doesn't have enough energy, but you use enough of them. You put a zillion of them into a piece of material, and you're doing what you and I call cooking. And so a whole lot of them at once, yes, can now at least raise the temperature of things, and that can change the chemical composition, and that's one of the things that you do when we call cooking. So if I'm now doing this experiment where I'm directing photons essentially one at a time across a dual slit, and then there's a screen beyond, and I want to find out, do they act like a wave or do they act like particles? If they acted like particles, you would see two bright spots on the screen where everything else would be shadowed by the rest of the aperture that contains the two slits. If they behave like a wave, you will see an interferometry pattern. My understanding is every time they do that experiment, you get an interferometry pattern, suggesting at least in that experiment, the photons that you're feeding, that you're shooting at this dual slit aperture, at least in that experiment, they seem to be acting wave-like, making this interferometry pattern. The thing that Barry and I were discussing 2 days ago, I think it was, is the fact that in order to detect one photon at a time, you can't have a person that's half pregnant. You can't measure half a photon. Your detector, whatever it is, it either does or doesn't measure the photon. So if you've got some kind of a counter on those two slits and you'd like to know how many photons went by, your counter is absorbing those photons. If it's not absorbing the photons, it's not counting them. I'm going to make a guess, Barry, that maybe what they did is did the experiment once where you have a counter on each one of the slits. Do the experiment again, assuming you get the same results because you know how many photons you're issuing. Now you do it without the counter being present. You're no longer absorbing the photons, and you look at the pattern that's being generated.
Repeater, timeout.
So then you look at the, you can do the experiment multiple times, and hopefully you'll get the exact same results. So one of those times you do the counting, and one of those times you look at the pattern that's created. That's a guess on my part. But I don't really know if some of these guys listening to us are more steeped in the physics of this particular experiment. I wish you'd give us your call letters, come forward right now, and tell us what you know, because I know I'm floundering a little bit on this one. MB is the guy who just asked that question. K2RIW is the guy who's talking right now. Give us your call letters if you have further information on that dual slit experiment that tried to settle on whether or not photons are a wave or a particle. Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? I am hearing one other weak signal, but no modulation. So we're not able to find out who that person's call letters are. Mel, Tell us what you know about this one. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Well, I remember from physics a very famous experiment called Bell's, B-E-L-L-S experiment. I don't know if you ever heard of that. With the analogy of a flying nail gun and what they was called, I think, a positronic sort of correlated pairs of photons. Basically, to boil it down to easy language, he showed that, for example, if you had bipolarized sunglasses, it would let the waves of light which are vibrating with the vertical orientation go through them while blocking light which vibrates horizontally. This was the basis of the experiment was what was called Bell's experiment, showing how the polarizer would work. I try to recall it in detail, but maybe I thought maybe I might have stirred some memory. I have to try to get it straight in my mind, but it was called Bell's experiment. Does that ring a bell in any way with you, Dick? Over.
No, it doesn't, Mel. However, that gives us one more search word to go to Google or some other search engine and try to find out more information. So I think we still got a bit of a mystery on this one, Barry. Barry and I were discussing a number of things, I guess it was 2 days ago, and this is one of the ones that really stuck with us. We also tried to speculate, I tried to speculate as to what is the real physical mechanism at the molecular level that goes on in a microwave oven that creates the heating of your water. The microwave oven, the majority of the cooking it does is the heating of the water that's in your food, and dry food, it doesn't cook. Ice, for instance, has almost no effect on it. As I told you guys, a lot of times you can put a snowball and a glass of water in the microwave oven simultaneously, and the glass of water gets hot, and the snowball, nothing happens to it. Or a block of ice, nothing happens to it. As long as there's a glass of water there at the same time. So the heating of water is an interesting thing to explain. So, go ahead, if you've got something to contribute on this one, Wesley.
Yeah, I have a few questions. One of them is, what is the significance of using the single photon if you are going to let the pattern build up anyway? And would it be feasible to use the CCD or something that can register a single photon in quasi real time? Back to you. Actually, what I was trying to say is the way that you could have the computer display the individual heats, where alongside the display could show the accumulation or accumulations that some faded of in different colors, and eventually register this heat on the display of different color in superimposed mode. Back to you.
Yeah, the nice thing about charge-coupled devices is that they are extremely efficient. When well-constructed, they've got a very low amount of dark current. In other words, they have very little extraneous signal. Properly used, and particularly if they're cryogenically cooled, they can literally count one photon at a time. So finding a detector to detect the photons is fairly doable. The problem is that your detector detects one photon at a time, and if you're doing an experiment where you want to know the number of photons that go through the right-hand slit versus the left-hand slit, your method of measuring the photons going through is absorbing the photons. You can't detect the presence of the photon by sucking out one-tenth of its energy and leave the other nine-tenths to go through. You either do or don't detect that photon. Therefore, you're disturbing the experiment. Kind of a Heisenberg uncertainty problem we've got here. The idea of hitting one photon at a time at a dual slit is that if the photons acted as a particle, you would simply see two bright spots on the screen beyond the two slits, Those two bright spots would be directly behind the two slits. If the particles going through the dual slits were acting in a interferometry pattern, like a wave, then they would make that more complicated sine X over X-like pattern on your film that gets exposed, so to speak, your screen beyond. So Barry and I have both heard about the counting of the photons, and I'm beginning to think you simply count the number of photons you've issued, and I guess you don't worry about, in one part of the experiment, you don't worry about whether they're not, let me drop, you don't worry about whether they go through the left slit or the right slit. You know how many photons you've issued, you've done it one at a time, and now you look at the result. And then you can repeat the experiment and put the photon detector in there to detect the fact that you've done the experiment fairly, that the number of photons that went through the left slit and the number of photons that went through the right slit is approximately the same number. So I'm beginning to think the experiment's got to be done in two stages, Barry, because if you have a detector that can detect a photon, you have, by my understanding, absorbed that photon in the process.
I have an addition.
Okay, go ahead, Wesley.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, the significance of that experiment is to convince me that the interference pattern is not produced by the interaction between different photons, but by each photon interfering with itself, which gives me the information, a hint, that a photon went through both slits at least the wave did. Back to you.
Yes, Wesley, that is the interpretation that I have, that the photon behaved in a wave-like manner, and each individual photon appeared to go through both slits, is one interpretation, obvious by the fact that you got the interferometry pattern on the screen that was beyond the two photons, beyond the two slits. So that's one possible interpretation. And I think we're all going to have to dig a little bit deeper on this one.
Another addition?
Yeah, go ahead, Wesley.
So I think it could be run, the experiment could be run at low density and for a very short period of time, very brief duration, and then I could gradually increase the duration, and I will be showing the photographic field developing on one, then two, then three, then whatever dots. Then I could run it at once for a very long period of time, showing development of the pattern. Am I right?
The whole idea of sending one photon at a time between the two slits is to find out which one photon act like a wave. If I put a large number of photons into the experiment during any one instant of time, then you know some of them are going through each slit, and the pairs of photons going through the slits, separate photons going through the slits, they could make an interferometry pattern, and now you have an ambiguity. You're not quite sure are the photons acting as a wave or as particles.
Yes, but isn't that the experiment should be done with electrons, because these are the charges that could be easily detected.
The experiment's got to be done with photons, not with electrons. Electrons are not photons. There may be a way of trading one for the other, but this is an experiment with pure photons, not with electrons.
Yeah, I understand that. I do. The only thing that I use the analogy that I would suggest that the lower intensity of the source until the one photon is emitted at the same time. I was just using the analogy. I know that it couldn't be done with the electrons. There is a problem with detecting of photons.
Yeah, if you did the experiment with electrons, you're going to get a pure pattern as if you've got particles. Obvious by the fact that you've got a kind of a screen that you put in front of old-fashioned cathode ray tube color television sets, and by the geometry of how you send the red, green, and blue beam from the gun assembly of the cathode ray tube, that geometry goes through the apertures and lights up the red dots, the green dots, or the blue dots of the phosphor on the screen. So electrons appear to really behave as particles. And they, I guess they are primarily particles. But this photon experiment is a bit baffling. And I guess we got to dig deeper, and I don't think we got an answer yet, Barry. N2 moon bounce. We're going to have to dig a little more into this one. K2RIW, over to you, Barry.
Yeah, okay. And there is a little twist to the experiment, which is really throwing me. What they said, and every time I've seen this experiment done, and it's been done many times, every time it's been done, they're making a statement, and this is a very macabre statement. They're saying, if you do not observe the photons before they go, if you don't count them, or, you know, an act of observing them, if you don't do that, you will get a wave pattern. That's a given. If you observe them, you'll get a particle pattern. But they're taking it a step further. They're saying, if you observe them, but don't look at the results, and promise never to look at the results, in other words, you destroy the counter, and now you go ahead and look at the results. A week later, the results that you get will be a wave pattern. However, if you waited a week, same week, but you decided, I'm going to look at the counter. If you look at the counter a week later, you'll get a particle pattern. Now, this experiment was done a long time ago. I don't know how they did it. That's confusing me. How could you make that statement if we can't figure out how in the hell they could have counted the photons or observed them, so to speak, in the first place? That's where I think the whole experiment is falling apart, unless somebody can come up and tell me how the hell they did that. And then the experiment would have some validity. K2RIW, N2MB.
And not in addition to...
experiment, look it up.
KC2, QIQ.
Yeah, Wesley and Glenn in that order. And Barry, when you get a chance, try to find a website where we can all look at this, or a reference. Wesley, go ahead with your comment.
Here's the point. We're talking about the electron. The only way it could be done with the photons is because it's much easier to do it, but the electron diffraction could be done if you fire the electron into the crystal. And the molecular structure of that crystal acts like a diffraction grid, they said properly. It can tell a lot about the structure of the crystal form and the diffraction part pattern that you can see. But you,
I'm not so sure that they've done an experiment with electrons. I know they've done it with X-rays. They've aimed X-rays at crystals and look at the pattern that you get of the waves that bounce off of the crystal and make a definite. You make a judgment as to what is the crystal. Geometry.
Yes, but the Young's experiment works only with monochromatic light.
Yeah, making monochromatic X-rays is a relatively easy thing to do, I believe. Glenn, wonder if you've heard about that experiment. What have you heard, and what do you believe is the interpretation? KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and good evening, everyone on the net tonight. Yeah, I kind of came in here late after watching the Jets game tonight, but I think I came in on the tail end of this, where I think you're talking about what was referred to like somewhere around the 1800s, the late 1700s, the Young dual split experiment, where basically light waves pass through a slit, and then they're basically measured on a screen behind the slit. Is this the correct experiment, Dick?
That's the one. And my interpretation of that experiment is that the photons sent one at a time through the dual slit, making the interferometry pattern beyond the two slits onto that screen, suggests that they're behaving in a wave-like manner. Over to you, Glenn.
Yeah, I'm just going back on I'm thinking of the history on this one. I think the original analysis of that was, in other words, this is going back to like, you know, 1800, that they realized at that time that there was both a wave and a particle pattern. But it wasn't actually, I think, almost into the 1900s where they started working out wave particle duality, and quantum mechanics was starting to be used in the early 1900s. So around that time, then they discovered photoelectric effect. So what they did there was, now if you know what the material of the screen is, they determined that the light wave passing through the slits is truly a wave. And when it strikes the pattern, they use the photoelectric effect with the amount of area of the slit and the intensity of the light. And they can determine with a quantum model the amount of photon energy associated to the wavelength of light that's hitting the screen, and then just calculate the intensity and the area, and knowing the material of the screen, and come up with a energy coefficient, if you follow what I'm saying. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Only if you've got billions of photons. That's the problem. We're trying to do this one photon at a time.
Comments?
Barry, I think that's a calculation. I don't know if anybody's actually measured one photon at a time. I'm going to pass it back to Dick. K2RIW, over to you.
And by the way, is that the Planck equation? Energy equals H nu. H, I think, is Planck's constant, and nu is the wavelength. In other words, once you know the wavelength, you know the amount of energy of one single photon. Is that the Planck equation? Do I have that correct, if you know Glenn first?
Right on, Dick. That's what it is. KC2QIQ.
Dumbin?
Hey, go ahead, Wesley.
I'm going to say the point of electrons. The fraction of electrons, if you take a rotating disk with a narrow slit cut in it, so the only electrons in the narrow range of the velocities can go through, then you would possibly be able to achieve the same effect vector.
Wesley, this is not going to work because you can't use electrons. You just can't use electrons for this experiment.
Yeah, with the dual slit experiment, rotating disks with teeth in them or whatever, that was one of the experiments that was used for measuring the speed of light. And in other words, you get an eclipsing of function when the slit rotates, when the teeth wheel rotates fast enough, and you're making pulses of light that are reflecting off a mirror at a mountain a mile away, so to speak, and at a certain speed you rotate the disk, the individual pulses come back, are now coming back during the block periods, and you don't see them. So this is an experiment which allows you to measure the speed of light. I noticed that you called it the Young's experiment, Glenn. Mel thought it was the Bell's experiment. You think it's the Young's experiment. If we do a web search on Young, Y-O-U-N-G or something like that, do you believe we'll find some further information? Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, it is.
Yes, Dick. The Young experiment is the one that I'm familiar with. That's the one that I remember. I haven't typed in, you know, that into Google yet, but if you were to type in duality, photon wave, Young, you'll come back with that late 1700s, early 1800s experiment. And to get the quantum and the photoelectric effect stuff, that's probably more like 1900. You might find stuff in there. Then type in like Planck's constant and all the other good stuff from there.
Yeah, let me just make a quick comment, please.
Yeah, go ahead, Barry.
Okay, see the thing, where we're running into a little bit of a problem here is that photons are not very big. And individual photons don't take up a lot of room. And if they're going through an individual photon, is small enough so you could probably make the argument it should only go through one slit at a time. It can't go through both, because it would have to be in two places at once, and it's a very small particle. So it shouldn't be able to do that. Yet that seems to be the way it's acting. And that's why I brought this up. And that particular argument came forth, and I think, I'll look it up now, but 1929. It's not all that far back.
K2KEY.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Yeah, we're speculating if the photons are very small. And by the way, the best experiment I know of, done very exactly, was done by the European Southern Observatory. They decided they're going to measure the light output of Halley's Comet. The family pronounces it Halley, but you know the comet I'm talking about, the one that comes back every 79 years or something like that. And last year or year before, it was at the aphelion. It was at the furthest distance from the sun, and I think it was something like 100 astronomical units, something like three times the distance of Pluto. And Halley's Comet is something that's black as the blacker than a piece of coal, and when it's that far out where Pluto, when you're sitting on Pluto, you look at the sun, you just say it's just an ordinary star. When you're three times beyond Pluto, you're seeing something extremely dim. So the reflected light from our sun hitting Pluto, coming back to European Southern Observatory, and they're using a telescope with something like an 8-meter diameter collecting parabolic mirror. And they were getting photons from Halley's Comet at that extremely strong distance of 1.5 photons per second, and they did it for some large number of hours in order to photograph the fact that this 29th magnitude, and each magnitude is, you know, as the numbers get bigger and bigger, you get less and less light. So that is the deepest measurement, not deepest, that is the darkest measurement that has ever been made. And they were literally counting 1.5 photons per second, or maybe I better call it 2 photons per 3 seconds or so on. You know what I mean. They were really measuring one photon at a time. But that was the rate at which they were coming. Let's see. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel, with your comment on this.
Yeah, I just want to make one quick comment. We'll turn it over to Mel, okay?
This is K2KEY. Well, to ask, I just looked up the New York Academy of Science, 1982. Heinz R. Pagel, professor of physics at Rockefeller University, did a study on the work of Einstein, Max Planck, and the describes in detail John S. Bell as the experiment. Seems that Bell's work was really advanced, done in 1920. So, as I said, it was Bell's experiment that explains this whole thing with the polarizations and the whole bit. Dick, over.
Okay, we're going to be looking that up. Go ahead, Barry. Wait for the beep.
Okay, I think maybe Dick can correct me on this, but I think what we're trying to say here, I think what's happening, and I think Dick hit upon it a minute ago, that these photons are not as small as we think they are. They may be a lot bigger. That may be what's going on here in 2MB.
Yeah, right now I don't know the size of one, and is that size different as a function of wavelength? Glenn, I think you wanted to make a further comment?
I think I'm going to yield at this point. Back to you, Vic.
And to you.
Go ahead, Wesley.
I know that Schrödinger was working on the mathematics in this area, and he was developing all of the equations and boundary conditions measurement representing the double slit experiment. But what I don't like is somebody say it could not be done with the electron, but the attempts are being made. It is just we don't know if it's done. What I can say is that I would like to know, really, for my own knowledge, is that you could anybody give me the reference for the exact derivation of the single photon double slit experiment?
I think we're going to have to research this one further, Wesley, and I think we're going to have to move on. And can you do the experiment with electrons? Absolutely. But that is a different experiment. The photon experiment and the electron experiment are two separate experiments, and most likely you're going to get a different result, I think. Next person who signed in was Howard, KC2 Oscar, Juliet Oscar. Go right ahead, Howard. Hope your question's a little bit easier than the last one. We weren't successful in the last one, Howard. We're batting zero tonight. Help us out. You got it, Howard. K2LIW, my name is Dick.
Dick, I just wanted to follow up with a final one on that one before you change.
Go ahead, Glenn.
I guess the thing that I was trying to understand is where the understanding of what a photon is, and you know, I just wanted to come back and you know maybe that my understanding is about a photon is a quantum model, and it's you have a light wave, it strikes a mass, and now you have once the light wave encounters a mass of some sort, you're going to have luminescence. Okay, you have kinetic energy at that point. The light wave gets absorbed, you get luminescence, you get heat. Now, if you want to determine how much energy was absorbed into that mass and how much luminescence is taking place, you use the quantum model, and the photon is the energy unit. So when you break that energy unit down to the molecular scale of an individual atom or molecule, what you're basically looking at is the energy unit associated to that mass from that electromagnetic wave. Now, here again, I think there's a miscomprehension here, if you follow what I'm saying, Vic. Let me just throw it back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Barry and I were trying to make a rough guess as to a single photon at, let's say, an optical frequency, 550 nanometers. Do you have a guess as to what the size of that object is? Or when a single photon hits a photoelectric surface, a photo-emitting surface, what percentage of the surface does the emitting? I mean, is there a way that we can put an approximate size on the thing? That's part of what's bothering us. Wait for the beep, you got it.
Okay, I see what the problem is. Okay, what you'd have to do is you'd have to know, okay, you have a light wave, an electromagnetic wave, and let's say it's in a vacuum, and now we have a mass, okay, and let's call that mass some, it has to be some material. Let's say it's an atom of oxygen, okay, you go down to the lowest molecular scale that you can look at of, let's say, of oxygen. When that light wave hits the oxygen, it's the mass of the oxygen that's absorbing that. So basically what you're doing is you're saying, okay, in that smallest element that you can break down matter into, how much electromagnetic wave gets absorbed, and then that would be the size, because the size is of the smallest element of that mass. Does that make more sense, Dick?
Yeah, that might help a little bit. And by the way, later on we get into the deeper subject, I've got a question I want to ask you going further than where we were last week when we signed off. Okay, we promise that this is a new improved TechNet. We're going to try to handle everybody during the first hour. Howard, KC2OJO, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW, my name is Dick.
Okay, I have a question about, I think it's somewhat simpler, unbalanced dipole. I'm imagining I want to feed an unbalanced dipole, but I'm going to make one arm about half a wavelength, and I'm going to make the other arm of the dipole about a tenth of a wavelength. And the interesting thing is, if I look at the charts that we've talked about that show Z versus the number of degrees of the antenna length, when I'm a little less than lambda over 2, I should be seeing something like 1K purely resistive. But when I'm at a tenth of a wavelength of the antenna, the other arm of the dipole, I also can see about 1K, but it'll be capacitive, purely capacitive, because the radiation resistance is essentially zero as opposed to the 1K resistance of the other arm. Let me drop from... So, I guess the question I have, when I look in, I want to drive this dipole now, it would appear that what I'm seeing, if I look directly into those terminals, would be a very tiny capacitor and a resistance, maybe about 1K. So if I have a balanced generator output, would I just want a 1K generator output impedance and somehow put in enough inductance to resonate with that tiny capacitance that's giving me the 1K on the other arm? Back to net.
And there's a little bit more to your question than you first realized, Howard. At first it's going to sound like I'm not answering your question, but I'm going to be giving you information that's going to eventually come around and make some sense. When Howard's talking about the curves, he's talking about the Brown and Woodward curves. Mr. Brown and Woodward did a man's years worth of work way back in 1948 where they took, you could say every possible dipole, but a dipole, you can divide the dipole in half and put it against a sheet of metal, and you and I call it monopole. Quarter wave monopole, for instance, is really a half of a dipole. So by way of monopoles, they chose every possible diameter and every possible length of an antenna, measured the resistive component, and measured the reactive component. Those two curves, the resistive component, reactive component, very valuable pieces of information. If you go to amateurradio.tv, and you page down to the section that says Yagi Technical Information by KQRIW. Good old Mike, I can't think of Mike's call letters right now, yes, Mike KC2NJI, Mike Perry, took that information and put it on that website. So you can see those two curves when you go to that particular place. Once you've got those curves, you just choose whatever diameter that your particular antenna is and choose whatever length you like, and you can measure the impedance of a monopole. And if you're building a dipole, it's really a pair of monopoles back-to-back. You just double all the resistance numbers and you double all the capacitance numbers you read. That's only a fraction of the story. Stand by. Now, there's two secrets you need to this whole process that hasn't been given to you, Howard, yet, in my opinion, in a form that's understandable. We all like to believe that the signal that's coming down our transmission line hits the antenna, it crawls down the wire and jumps into space, and that's what an antenna is. That's what we want to believe. That's not what happens at all. The signal coming out of your transmission line goes onto the wire of your dipole, and only a very small fraction of it, like 5% of it, gets radiated on the first pass. The energy comes down to the end of the dipole, sees an open circuit, reverses, and bounces back. When you've got an antenna that is a resonant dipole, and you've got to resonate first before you can radiate efficiently, when you've got a resonant dipole, the energy you're putting on the dipole must bounce back and forth something like 20 times before it gets radiated. And what you and I are doing when we set the resonant length of the antenna electronically is that we're making sure that all of those bounces stay in step, stay co-phase. That's what resonance really is. Now, once you accept that a dipole really is a resonant structure, that's why it's called classically a standing wave structure. The only kinds of antennas that don't do this are rhombic and Beveridge. There, the energy flows down the wire once, goes into a terminating resistor, and doesn't reflect back. That's a rare antenna by my standards. So once you accept the fact that your dipole is a resonant structure, the energy bounces back and forth, let me drop, I'm going to give you the next piece of information that's going to be very valuable to you. And that is, if you're using the right kind of a balancing device, and by balancing device I mean it makes sure that the signal coming out of your transmission line is presented to the dipole in a fully differential manner. In other words, you're at one instant of time you're driving the right-hand side of the dipole positive and the left-hand side negative, and the next half cycle you're doing the opposite. But as long as you've got a balancing structure, making sure you're driving the dipole in a differential manner, and hopefully a really good balancing structure also acts like an RF choke, which will not allow RF energy to flow back down the outside of the coax if you're using coax. Once you accept the right kind of a balancing structure, you'll soon discover there is nothing magic about feeding the center of the dipole. You can feed it in the center, you can feed it one-third of the way off center, you can feed it 90% off center, or you can feed it at the end. You could, if you want to, make a vertical dipole, half-wave long piece of wire without the center insulator, and feed it at the bottom. You'll see a 1,000 ohm or a 1,500 ohm resistive impedance, but the dipole will behave exactly the same way once you're smart enough to do that. You study what's inside of a 5/8 wave mag mount, 2-meter antenna. You'll find out that they're really feeding the bottom half of something that is essentially a half-wave resonant structure, that vertical thing that they call 5/8 wave, and you'll see that it's got a step-up coil in that mag mount structure in the bottom, which does that impedance matching for you. So with the right kind of a balancing structure, you can feed the dipole anywhere you want, and now once you accept the fact that you're feeding it anywhere you want, and by way of the Brown and Woodward curves, you can figure out exactly what impedance you're going to see. Yes, you can figure out the impedance of the left-hand side, figure out the impedance of the right-hand side, and they're unbalanced, and those two impedances are in series with each other if you've got the right kind of a balancing structure. Maybe that helps a little bit. I know that's a little left of center of what you were...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Back to you, Howard, for amplification of your question. KC2OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Exactly what I was asking, whether I could put the impedance that I see looking into the left and looking into the right in series, basically from those curves. So what that would say, if I see 1K resistive in the half-wave section looking to the right, And if I see a small capacitor, about 1K capacitive looking to the left, then if I'm right up there, forget about the transmission line momentarily, all I have to do is drive it with a generator that's 1K resistive and has enough inductance to cancel the capacitance, and I'm okay. Now I get to the second part of my question. What happens when I put a balanced transmission line, like open wire, and try to drive it from the other end back to net?
That is a good question. And here I'm going to be giving you some of my gut feel from my experience of feeding lots and lots of dipoles over the last 40 years or so. In my opinion, Howard, each half of the dipole has a certain impedance to the rest of the universe. If I decided to feed a half-wave dipole that's vertically polarized, let's assume now that I've got a tall enough tree and I'm making a half-wave dipole on 40 meters. It's 65 feet long. I've got 65 feet of vertical wire without a center insulator suspended by a tree. And at the bottom of that wire, I feed it with reference to Earth. Now I'm going to see something like a 1,500 ohm resistive impedance. If I'm smart enough, it's fairly easy to match that, at least at one frequency at a time. So the right way to feed an antenna when it's very unbalanced is either feeding it against Earth, or if I'm trying to feed it with open wire line, now I've got a problem. If the open wire line is not in the center of the dipole, if the open wire line is not the one lead going to ground, the other lead going to the one end of the dipole, so to speak, and even then I wouldn't be using the open wire line in a fully balanced manner. So let me backtrack. If I want full performance out of open wire line, it looks like I'm forced to feed the dipole in the center. You and I could come up with a balloning-like structure that I put at the end of the open wire line that forces the antenna to be fed in a differential manner, and yet it's like an RF choke so that RF energy cannot flow down in a common mode manner down the open wire line. If I jump over to coax cable feed, and if my balloning structure is either a whole lot of turns of the coax acting as an RF choke, or the equivalent of I do that with ferrite beads, ferrite toroids, I can now make sure that the outside of the transmission line will not accept the common mode signal. And I know I've got to do a little bit of explanation as to what is differential mode versus common mode. Twin lead fed in the center of a dipole, everything is symmetrical, and now everything is in the differential mode. Once I start sliding the open wire line off of center, now I'm creating a kind of imbalance. In other words, the impedance the right-hand side of the open wire line sees and the impedance the left-hand side are not equal to each other, and now some signal flows down the open wire line in a common mode manner. Common mode manner, I could make the extreme of common mode manner by taking in the shack the two leads of the open wire line, shorting them together, feed that combination with reference to ground. That's pure common mode feeding. If I feed plus 1 volt to the right side and minus 1 volt to the left side during this instant of time, I'm feeding it in a thoroughly differential manner. Your open wire line is not looking at a balanced load when it is off to one side of the dipole. So now you have to do some kind of choking action to stop the common mode signal on the open wire line. It's not a showstopper, but if you've got common mode signal on the open wire line, it is no longer a shielded structure. Now your transmission line is radiating. You might desire to do that if you're smart enough with the design, and maybe G5RV antenna has been intentionally doing that in some modes of its operation. But now, if you desire the antenna to...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you desire the antenna to do all the radiating and not do any radiating from your transmission line, and your transmission line is open wire line, then you've got this differential versus common mode problem to be solved when you're feeding the dipole off center. I wonder if that makes a little more sense. This is not a simple issue we're going into here, Howard. KC2OJO, You're taxing us tonight. KQRIW in the TechNet.
Okay. I certainly can understand that the transmission line is seeing something very funny in that if I go up to the antenna, I see a tiny capacitor or a large resistor according to which wire I'm on. And if I put a balun up at the antenna, that seems okay. I could force it to be differential. My next question is, if I go down to the transmitter side and put the balun there, it's hard for me to see how the transmission line can radiate at that point, since if I have the balun at the transmitter side, I should be getting equal currents up the balanced line, and the radiation, I would think, would cancel. Back to net.
A very good assumption, but I think there's a slight error here, Howard. If I've got the right kind of a antenna tuner, one that's got a differential coil through it, one of these floating coil type a transformer built into the antenna tuner, I can feed open wire line in a fully differential manner. In other words, whatever positive voltage I put on the right-hand wire, I'm putting the exact same negative voltage on the left-hand wire during this instant of time. And if I do that, in theory, the open wire line does not radiate. In other words, at every instant or every position along that line, the positive voltage on the right side and the negative voltage on the left side are exactly balanced. The currents are in opposite directions. Everything cancels and no radiation takes place. There's a catch. That condition is only true if the transmission line sees a thoroughly balanced load. In other words, the impedance of the right-hand wire, when at the right-hand side of the antenna, its impedance to the universe must be identical to the impedance of the left-hand side of the antenna to the universe. Any imbalance in those two impedances will force a unbalanced common mode signal to flow back down the transmission line. A transmission line, if it's 600 ohm open wire lead, for instance, it wants to see an exactly 600 ohm resistor between the two wires with no other resistance anywhere else in the universe. Or, conversely, let me drop. You could say the 600 ohm line wants to see a 300 ohm resistor to ground on the right side and a 300 ohm resistor to ground on the left side, and therefore between the two, it's looking at those two 300 ohm resistors in series and it sees 600 ohms. So you must obey that balanced load condition. In other words, the right impedance between the two wires and equal impedance from either of those wires to ground in order for the open wire line to be used in a thoroughly balanced manner. You disturb that balance, you will be forcing a common mode signal on the on the transmission line, and any common mode signal most likely will radiate. I know that's not so easy to understand the first time you hear it, but I wonder if it makes some sense, Howard. KC2OJO, K2RIW on the TechNet.
I guess what's bothering me is if I feed the bottom of the transmission line at the transmitter end in a differential mode only, what we're saying is that regardless of that, I am going to see a common mode signal because of the fact that at the load it is unbalanced. And therefore, what's radiating is the common mode part of it. What this says to me, in a sense, is that while I do have a series circuit of the resistor and the capacitor at the antenna load, and it looks like something in series, because it's not balanced, and I don't understand that, because if it's in series, it should be balanced, it will actually radiate anyway. Back to net.
I think I know where you are, Howard, and I feel for you, but let me propose this particular experiment. Let's assume now that I'm testing the quality of open wire line not to radiate, and you've got the right kind of a feeding structure in the shack that's fully feeding your open wire 600 ohm line in a differential manner. Out in the backyard, where the load should be. In your first experiment, you bring the lead close to the ground, and you put a 600 ohm non-inductive resistor across the two wires, and you measure the standing wave ratio, you measure the radiation, everything's hunky-dory. Let's assume now that in your backyard, close to where that 600 ohm resistor was, you have an extremely large sheet of copper, which by definition, I'm going to say is grounded. So you've got a very large sheet of copper, and you've got the 600 ohm resistor sitting a foot above that copper. That's very little straight capacitance, no problem. If now you take the 600 ohm floating resistor and you bring it down to the copper sheet and you ground the right-hand side of the open wire line, and the left-hand side is sticking up in the air with nothing there but the 600 ohm resistor. So at the end of the open wire line, you've got a pure 600 ohm resistor, but you have now grounded one of those leads to the copper sheet. Let's assume now that you're feeding a 2-volt signal into the open wire line differentially. I could say there's 1 volt with reference to ground positive on the right side, 1 volt negative with reference to ground on the left side is what's going down the transmission line. But at the end of the transmission line, because one of those leads was grounded, you have forced that voltage at that point to be 0 with reference to ground. Now you've got 2 volts across the 600 ohm resistor. The lead of the open wire line that's hanging up above the copper sheet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The ungrounded lead has 2 volts of swing on it. The grounded lead has 0 volts of swing on it. So I've got a very unbalanced load, an extreme case with this great big sheet of copper in my example. That will launch a signal back down that line. Because even though the line appears to be properly loaded, it's got a 600 ohm load, but you've got an unbalanced load, and now because at that point in space, there's 2 volts of swing on the ungrounded lead, there's 0 volts of swing on the grounded lead, I could call that, I'm not sure now if the number, I think I would call that a 3-volt common mode signal exists at that point. Therefore, the line will start radiating when you do that. That's what I believe. I know that that's not an easy one to accept, but I wonder if you can get that picture as to where I'm going on this one, Howard. KC2OJO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Fine.
Dick, one thing I just wanted to comment is that you sort of violated the first principle because you referenced the voltages with respect to ground. If I truly have a floating output at the transmitter end of the open wire line, they are not referenced to ground, and as a matter of fact, I'm not quite sure where ground comes in at the transmitter end if it's truly balanced. Back to net.
Yeah, we promised everybody we're going to handle everyone during the first hour. If you're willing to spend a little bit more time after we finish the third person and the mailbag, then we can go back to this subject and discuss it some more. Because tomorrow might be a vacation day for you, are you willing to stay a little bit longer, Howard? Back to you, sir.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, certainly am.
Okay. The next person that was on the list, we're going to try to handle him real fast, was Ed. N2 November Yankee Whiskey. Go right ahead, Ed. K2RIW, my name is Dick. Okay, maybe Ed is not there. One last call, November 2, November Yankee Whiskey from Sheepshead Bay. Ed, are you there? Okay, we did promise to get to everybody in the first hour, and within approximately 1 minute of error, we did do that. I guess it's time to go over to the mailbag, Mel. What kind of questions have you gotten this week? K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, I'll just say one final word on what you were discussing. What is the word matched? I'll give a simple explanation of the word matched. That's when a line terminated through a load equal to the complex characteristic of the line impedance. That is what is meant by matched. Everything after that will take it in more complex, but that's the basic meaning of the word matched. Let's see. Yeah, I'm looking here. Very good. All right. Well, I got questions mostly from people that are looking to build, like we were talking about projects last week. And they're wondering, do you know of any sources of parts? It seems like to go to